Welcome to the 31st episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as rain stops play across the country, we promise that this podcast won't be a washout.
But it's been interesting because when the rain has abated a bit and the players have got out into the middle, particularly in the counties, I think there's been some pretty interesting cricket happening.
I think Mark Ramprakash would disagree with you.
Mark Ramprakash would disagree with me, and actually quite a lot of batsmen would disagree with me, and no doubt the ECB would disagree with me. I remember last summer we talked about quite a lot when the ECB came out and condemned Hampshire for a pitch that, quotes, demonstrated excessive turn. And I think that kind of attitude has sort of seeped into a lot of batsmen's minds at the moment, which is that if they can't go out and fill their boots, then there's something wrong.
It's now, there's almost an entitlement, isn't there? There's a sense of entitlement. We should be playing on good batting.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's plenty of opportunity later in the summer for, you know, Ramprakash to go down to Taunton and to, you know, spend
3 days batting.
Three days, you know, clocking up some runs. But I think at this stage in the season, actually, it's quite nice to see some proper green early season wickets, some seamers doing well. And I think actually throughout the summer, you can get a whole variety of pitches. And I think it's no bad thing that batsmen are being made struggle. It's also produced some absolutely excellent games. That Middlesex Surrey game, where Middlesex sneaks by three runs when Surrey needed.
It's certainly, there's no lack of drama. I mean, what is fun is you're checking quick info at the moment, and the scorecards you're getting are astonishing. I mean, the other day I saw Kent 9 for 5 in a game, and it's incredible drama. I mean, I just wonder one point. I guess it's been made by a few people. I mean, Rory Hamilton-Brown made the point that actually he feels there's very little skill actually going on batting in these conditions, that you actually just have to gamble and swing, and that actually you can't really hang around. It's so unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, similarly, maybe there are some quite mediocre bowlers who are picking up some stunning early season form.
Yeah, there are, absolutely. But it means that batsmen really have to have to adapt. Hamilton Brown, for instance, has come out of it really well.
Successfully.
And I don't think it's a bad thing for batsmen to have life made difficult for them. You know, there will be plenty of times come the August bank holiday when they can just go out and score runs on flat tracks. So,
I guess, I mean, it's also interesting because away from what happened at the Rose Bowl last year, this really just isn't anyone's fault, you know.
No,
we're in extraordinary
conditions. Well, if it's anyone's fault, this is the other thing, if it's anyone's fault, it's the ECB's fault for starting the season so early.
Ludicrously early.
So actually, they don't have anyone to blame but themselves. Mm. And actually, I think, I mean, it's ridiculous to have, I think this year, the first ever county championship scored in March was scored because the first game started on the 31st of March. So there are 31 days in March or 30, I don't know. But anyway, it was scored in March, which was just a ridiculous fact.
There has been, the pitches have been interesting. There has been something sad about the amount of cricket lost, and we'll get on to that. Yep. I mean, what I've been finding interesting is something that I don't think I would really expect myself to say, but I've slowly, in some sense, been coming round to the IPL. I had quite an interesting, it wasn't quite a Damascus moment, but one of my sort of non-cricket loving housemates walked in while I was watching it, very much on the background, and started by saying, firstly, this isn't cricket. Then he said, well, this must just be the highlights. And I realised that this is exactly what the IPL was always supposed to be. That for people who never accessed the game, to see it and think, God, this is quite exciting. God,
and is that then will he be converted to going and watching?
We'll have to see. I think he's shown genuine interest. So, we'll see.
And we do, of course, have the West Indies coming to Lords.
Of course,
in the near future. So
the opportunity is there. I think for me, it's been a matter of convenience. The IPL is on when I get back from work, and I like to whack it on in the background.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because it's on ITV4, and actually I've been watching a little bit of it as well recently.
This feels like a sort of confession session, doesn't
it?
I've been doing a little bit of IPL recently.
Yeah, I don't like to talk about it in public, but we're putting it out there on the airwaves. And it's kind of a bit like, you say this thing about convenience and having it on in the background. It's sort of made itself quite effectively into a little bit of a sort of soap opera, in the sense that you do, it's always there at the end of the day when you come home from work, put your feet up, watch half an hour of IPL, and then go and do something decent with the evening.
And the individual performances are exciting. I mean, I watched a bit of death bowling recently with Azam Mahmood, and you're just like, God, there's some wonderful cricket on. Yeah. What I haven't, I can enjoy the individual performances, and you are seeing some wonderful players in action, but the whole concept as a whole, I'm struggling to get into. I still can't. The format is so bloated. The fact that you seem possible to lose, like it seems to be very possible to lose lots and lots of games and still progress. The fact that every single game doesn't really seem to be of any major significance to itself.
Having watched a fair bit of IPL myself over the weekend, this is the one thing that kind of both pleasantly surprised me and let me down, was the fact that there is some, undoubtedly, some phenomenal skill and some really, really interesting cricket going on. I'm thinking particularly of watching AB de Villiers against Dale Steyn at the end of a game between, I can't remember which.
Well, it would be the Royal Challengers Bangalore and someone else.
So before the podcast, dear listeners, Andy was proving the fact that he's become an IPL convert by rattling through all the players he knows and the teams they play for. And I think we've got four players.
It's a 100% improvement on last season.
It's 100% improvement on last season. So, but I just, whilst there are these moments of amazing skill, so this AB de Villiers, Dale Steyn battle. I just struggle with quite a lot of the packaging of it. In one of the games I was watching, there was indeed watchers were invited to pick between two troops of dancing girls, the ones that they thought were about to come on the boundary. And I mean, the commentary is shockingly
bad. For a sport that cricket often, I really think exceeds other sports when it comes to commentary. In the IPL, it really has sort of taken a backward step. There's also a bizarre phenomenon of talking to players while they're at the pitch. I had a very surreal moment watching Virat Kohli, who I'm really warm into actually as a batsman, being interviewed while he's out on the pitch. And the guy asked him, "So have you got any new tattoos, Virat?" To which Kohli just replied, "No." And I thought, that's real insight. I'm really glad we brought that.
It's a great standard.
I'm still waiting for the moment when a ball is smashed at a player while talking and he messes up the catch. That's my kind of holy grail.
Yeah, exactly. So have you actually managed to watch any cricket?
Well, so my great letdown, I think we mentioned this in the last podcast, the ambition to go and watch the first day of the West Indies tour. A game at Hove against Sussex. And for me, really exciting. Never been to Hove as a ground. And it was very upset. I think, as most cricket fans would realise, that first game of the summer is quite a momentous event. You know, you really feel like the summer's underway. Got there, wasn't raining, but within half an hour they'd called off play for the day because of the wet outfield, described I think by the announcer as like a pudding. Incredibly frustrating for a fan because you're like, well, it's not raining, and you're looking at the pitch and you're thinking, God, if we were a sort of club side, we'd be out there, in a shop. But at the same time, obviously different concerns.
Where else would, in what other kind of weekend activity would the whole thing be called up under such circumstances?
I wonder whether
cricket is shooting themselves in the foot.
So, and sadly, this was kind of what the feeling I was left with personally, disappointing, miss out on a day's cricket. But you think more generally about the game as a whole, and you think, how long are people going to have patience for a sport in which you plan, you put a day aside, you book your tickets, you go down, and you don't get a moment's play. Yep. And cricket fans, frankly, always impressed me with their hardiness. I mean, on this day, people, you know, there was there was a beer festival running concurrently with the game.
People
hit the festival and enjoyed themselves. But at the same time, you think, well, God, if this happened in any other sport, any other form of entertainment, you know, whether it be a concert, a football match, whatever, it would be considered extraordinary. And I hope that people are willing to stick with this in cricket.
So, from the archives, in this episode, Andy is going to take us through the history of the short leg fielder.
Of all the positions on the cricket pitch, short leg probably requires the most specific set of skills. I mean, if you play somewhere like slips, clearly you do need skills of some sort. Even if you're playing out on the boundary, you need to have sort of the strong arm. But you can't sort of put anyone in at short leg. It requires very specific abilities in terms of reaction. More than that, perhaps, it requires extreme bravery as well.
It does. Having said which, it is usually, is it not, just the youngest person in the team who gets put there? Which says something quite interesting about the position, doesn't it? That it's not as if you want to put your most skillful fielder there. You just merely need to persuade someone to...
I think in club cricket in particular, it's really seen as a bit of a short straw, or you kind of want someone to sort of stand up and volunteer for the position.
But is it not in... I mean, Alistair Cook, for instance, fielding there, he certainly won't when he becomes England captain, you know, and he has kind of graduated from there as well. So it's that interesting position between the need for bravery / being told by your captain that if you want to stay in the squad, you're going to have to field there, and the, as you say, the range of skills.
I guess there's quite a division in there between the genuinely enthusiastic short leg fielders, the people who do it and like it, and the people who do it and sort of dump there.
I mean, reluctant short leg fielder, there's no more sadder sight on a cricket pitch than someone who's been shoved there by a captain.
I mean, it's when you look at the sort of the pitch as a whole and you think, well, yes, you do need specific skills to play in certain positions, but really in short leg, it's those rapid reactions that to do the job well, you don't really need those anywhere else on the pitch. I mean, slips to a lesser extent. In terms of danger as well, it is clearly a position apart. There is nowhere where you are fielding quite that close to the bat. And particularly, you know, you're thinking these monstrous pull shots and stuff. You really are straight in the firing line. I sort of began the research for this by trying to hunt down the best short leg fielder of all time. And I was kind of astonished to find that there really is a consensus on this. There's lots of lively debate and a fair few names put forward. But there's one name that comes up repeatedly again and again. And one name that all the greats, really, all the big players played... always go back to. And a guy probably we haven't heard of before. Eknath Solkar played 27 tests for India and actually had pretty limited success as an all-rounder. Averaged just 25 with the bat and almost 60 with the ball. So it's hardly
subtractive. So he had to carve a niche for himself.
Right. Well, he was rather cruelly referred to as a poor man's Gary Sobers, which actually, to be honest, with figures like those, I'd probably take a poor man's Gary Sobers as a description. But his record as a short leg fielder was nothing short of extraordinary. He took 53 catches in those 27 tests, which in itself, I mean, is astonishing productivity.
When was he playing?
He was playing in the 60s and early 70s as well. So, yeah, that was sort of his time. He, in particular, he forged a partnership with the Indian spinners at the time that made him almost indispensable in the side. And I think that's something that will continue to come on to later in the show, that this idea that partnership between short leg and spinners is an absolute key part of the game.
Yeah, it's like between quick bowlers and keepers, isn't it?
Right, and you need sort of that understanding. And actually, a lot of the spinners, the Indian spinners at the time, were happy to concede that their records were considerably boosted by having someone like Solkar who could put the batsman under pressure and could take chances. Probably his most famous moment, we're at the Oval, it's 1971, England playing India, and after two draws, this is the decisive test match of a three-test series. England have claimed a 71-run first innings lead and seem pretty well set. They're then routed for just 101, and absolutely key within this collapse is Solkar's astonishing dismissal of Alan Knott. There's no footage, or at least I've been unable to find any footage of the moment, but there's a rather brilliant photo, and Solkar is lying at full stretch with the ball in his hand, in just extraordinary position. And what I love about this image is the fielders and batsmen are all in mutual astonishment, just staring at this. And all the sort of records of the catch just make it sound quite extraordinary. In particular, it was referred to as similar to the great Gordon Banks save that's often referred to as sort of the definitive footballing save, where Banks seems to react quicker than it's physically possible. Solkar, when asked for what his secret for playing this position so well, said, "I only watch the ball." So he was giving very little away. His obituary put it rather well. Solkar had made the dangerous forward short leg position his own with his supple arms, lightning reflexes, hawk-like eyesight, brilliant anticipation and amazing concentration, all without a helmet, arm guards or shin guards, which is extraordinary, really. You're playing that dangerous position and you're backing your reflexes.
It's interesting what he was saying about "I only watch the ball," because Brian Close, infamously at short leg, would not flinch if someone played a hook towards him. He would stay there. He would stay crouching because he would say, "Oh well, you don't know if they're going to make a mistake." Yes, there might be a long hop off an off spinner, and he's looking, shaping to pull it straight towards me. But you don't know where the edge is going to come. And there is infamously that ball, which I don't know whether the story is apocryphal or not, and I'm sure it probably is, but where it was hooked, came off his forehead and went for six off his forehead. And so that kind of, I only watched the ball. And you see, at the moment, we're very used to seeing short leg fielders. Basically, as soon as a ball is pulled a little bit short, or the batsman shapes to play an aggressive shot on the leg side, you're very used to the short leg fielder immediately taking evasive action. But this kind of attitude whereby you just, you know, keep your eye on the ball all the way through is something completely different.
It's funny you mentioned that, because there was a good piece while researching this on Ian Bell describing his sort of experience in the field, and he's very honest about the fact that he quite early will decide to jump out the way very early on in the season. And he really phrased it as pretty much common sense. I mean, close also famously used to say, well, the ball can't hurt you, it only really touches you, it only touches you for a second. Which I just has never made convincing logic to me.
Which is a good argument of stepping out in front of a bus as well.
But I suppose that leads us on quite naturally to the fact that this is a position of immense skill and immense bravery. Well, when done well, you know, when the short legs played well. But it's also, it is the most dangerous position on the pitch. And it brings on to the fact, the tragic death of Indian Test batsman Raman Lamba, who, again, there are sort of different opinions on this, but he's certainly seen as one of very, very few people to have actually died while on the field of play as a cricketing resulted, not as a batsman, to actually have died in the field. And in his case, it was the 22nd of February 1998. He was playing in the game in the Bangladesh Premier League Division when a powerful pull shot sent the ball into his forehead. And the key thing here, no helmet. Mm. And I guess now, looking at the game today, that would be sort of seen as inconceivable. The impact was so great, and actually, you read this, and this is quite sickening to actually imagine. The impact was so great, the ball deflected off him and carried to the wicketkeeper, which gives you it's a really sickening picture of the image. There's also a rather horrible story that the incoming batsman came in and actually spoke to Lamba, and Lamba said, "I think I'm dead," and then passed out, which was an extraordinary, you know, obviously it's a horrible moment. Taken to hospital and could not be saved.
This podcast has suddenly taken a very, very morbid turn.
Well, it's interesting, because while I was researching this, I was thinking, there are these rare tragic moments in cricket, and maybe our podcast sort of steers clear of them generally, but reading this did make me think.
Well, it makes you realise quite how dangerous the position is, because there's a comparable situation with when, I think it was Farrukh Engineer was hit in the back of the head by Charlie Griffith in the 62 West Indian India series, and he was hit in the back of the head, and he went by Charlie Griffith, who was bowling kind of well into the 90s, and he was eventually, I mean, I don't think he ever played cricket again, but he was eventually okay. But it just makes you realise that, I mean, because we always talk about, you know, you talk about body line and you talk about helmets for bats, but actually short leg is an incredibly dangerous. And even for, you know, Ian Bell jumping out of the way when someone shapes the pull, if you get hit anywhere on the, you know, even on the side of the head, if you're ducking a short leg, it's
And I think the reason these events matter, I mean, aside from the obvious, the huge personal tragic loss, is the fact that it does remind you that we are sometimes blasé about the way we talk about danger in cricket, and the fact is it is sort of extremely real. It's a very genuine aspect of the game. And just think, well, you know, when we talk about From the Arcos, when we talk about cricket's history, these tragic events are sadly as much a part of it as some of the sort of great stories. I mean, I guess just to sort of conclude, it's interesting looking at the way short leg works now and functions now as a position. It's always seemed to me a sort of bold statement of intent from a captain when you turn to your bowler and say, right, we're putting in a short leg. Or alternatively, when a bowler turns to a captain and says, right, I want a short leg. It always seems like a sort of an aggressive and a sort of deep, psychologically putting a statement out there.
But you don't get short legs in 2020, really. And you also get short leg has become also quite a defensive position when you're crowding people around a batsman and saying, go on then, if you want to just prod away,
I think England had a horrible time with it in Pakistan and Sri Lanka, actually, the short leg fielder.
Exactly.
It's that psychological intimidation. I mean, there's no one else in the pitch who can quite get in a batsman's face like a short leg fielder. I mean, it's impossible really to take one's guard unaware of this person who's standing. So there is that sort of psychological aspect to it. I mean, I wondered whether, talking about it in limited overs, we've seen constant innovation within 2020. Maybe that's something that we'll see to come. Maybe that would be an interesting sort of game-shifting move, bringing a short leg. ¶¶ Next up, we've got the interview, which is a new feature for the show, where we're hoping each episode to have a leading cricket writer, broadcaster on. This week, we were delighted to be joined by Oliver Brett, who now writing on football, but spent much of his career writing on cricket for BBC. I've started by asking him his thoughts on the current state of cricket journalism today.
Obviously, one big factor, and it cuts across all types of journalism in sport, is the use of sort of ex-players to write a lot. And you sort of, you know, you don't see perhaps as much of it in cricket as you do in other sports, but it's something that does sort of, you know, occasionally grate a little bit.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking with, so kind of obviously Michael Atherton's kind of really established his niche at the Times.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see Crick Info have now given sort of Ed Smith quite a large platform. I mean, do you think there, when you say it grates, I mean, do you think there is a sense that it's restricting opportunities for maybe sort of journalists who've come up the more sort of traditional route?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, if you look at what happened with Angus Fraser, for example, he was employed by The Independent, essentially, as their cricket correspondent. And, I mean, I remember working alongside Angus a few times, and he didn't look as though he was particularly enjoying what he had to do.
Mm.
he'd obviously taken the job thinking it was a fairly glamorous lifestyle, and there was a lot of sort of tedium as well. You know, there's a lot of sitting around waiting for things to happen and then, you know, finding out you're not about to interview the person you thought you were about to interview, and then you get your sports editor on the phone saying he wants you to do a particular story which you hadn't bargained on. And I remember a few times Angus finding it all a bit sort of not particularly something that he was enjoying, which you usually think is extraordinary, because, I mean, a number of people out there who would just love to be cricket writers.
Do you think, it's an interesting one, because do you think the problem's sort of originating from county cricket, where more and more the papers seem kind of unwilling to commit journalists who actually do that sort of day-to-day work at the county grounds?
You mean so they're unwilling to promote them to do this sort of grander international...
Yeah, and I suppose, and I mean, there's been stuff sort of over the last couple of years about how some of the papers just aren't willing to commit the sort of the staff to necessarily, you know, have correspondence at all the different grounds. So whether maybe that's kind of cutting off the opportunities for journalists to... that would be a more traditional route.
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. Last couple of seasons, some of the newspapers, sort of through their online offerings, have gone very heavily into the sort of live county blog route. You know, you've got The Guardian doing it. You've got Crick Info.
Crick Info have got their new one, haven't they? Yeah.
But again, you know, these are actually freelance journalists who are probably quite, you know, been doing it for years and years. They're just being sort of re-employed in different ways. I'm concerned about the age of a lot of the county journalists. They're all sort of 40s and 50s, you know, and we'd love to see some sort of younger guys sort of coming through. And there are one or two, but it's sort of, you know, an old man's game, really.
And I mean, that's a really interesting point to make, because you're basically saying that, I mean, the younger journalists aren't coming through because the opportunities aren't there, perhaps, or the interest.
No, well, partly, but also, of course, it's the older writers are, you know, I get the sense they'll cling on to the position they've got, because, I mean, media employment is a very sort of, it's being constricted all the time. You know, there aren't the same quantity of jobs, staff jobs, anywhere as there were 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, if someone's got a decent gig, they're going to want to
hold on to it. Yeah. I mean, in terms of sort of where cricket journalism is as a whole, how do you see the sort of the blogging craze? I mean, do you see that as a kind of a sort of worthwhile alternative, or, I mean, how that sort of sphere of cricket journalism?
A worthwhile alternative. I mean, I guess, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because for years we've had, you know, county scores uploading on CFAX, and then Crick Info did it on the web, and now you want a sort of few words to accompany it, and then you're increasingly sort of marginalising the sort of daily report angle of cricket writing, and it is, you know, the media world is moving very, very fast, and, you know, you're not going to read, I mean, I remember when I was, you know, when I was at school, there was some reading county cricket reports, getting quite a lot of depth on some Division 2 games and things like this. never see that even in the broadsheets now. Which, and so, yeah, a lot of the traditional writers have adapted to...
Because it does seem like a bit of a shame, because especially reading some of the really older cricket writing, sort of Neville Cardis's and whatever, they were given the right to sort of write about games in ridiculous depth, and it was where sort of some of the real pleasure of the cricket writing came from. Do you think sort of moving a little bit away from cricket journalism towards sort of cricket sort of literature, there does seem to be cricket books or sort of books on cricket do seem to enjoy sort of a lot of success, maybe compared to sort of as a field compared to other sort of sports books. I mean, do you think that's going to become maybe sort of an increasing area where journalists who can't sort of have a sort of solid career within cricket journalism looked, I guess it's not an option for everyone, but look to create books?
Yeah, no, I think it is an option. It's not particularly well paid, actually, writing. Not really. I mean, if you get a commission from an agent to, for example, write an official biography of a player or an ex-player, if you sort of cost... I mean, I've never done it, but I've looked into it, and a lot of colleagues of mine have done it, and what they've sort of said is you never, ever go into it if you're expecting to sort of make money out of it. You know, make sure you have your usual regular stream of income on the side, and... But it's something I would definitely like to do. I've had a few ideas, actually.
Really, but it's interesting that you still sort of feel it's more of a labour of love than a sort of genuine or genuine alternative. So moving away, I guess, because, I mean, it's really interesting, moving away from the extent to which cricket journalism is changing. I mean, I just wondered, sort of looking at, I guess, the game as a whole... if you were in the position where you had the sort of power and influence to make real change at somewhere like the ICC, I mean, where would you start? It's a difficult question, but with all the issues...
Where would I stop? Listen, they've made one quite good decision recently. I believe they're going to scrap the Champions Trophy. Because we were getting to the stage that the ICC were sort of sanctioning global tournaments and all over the place, and everyone has lost any sort of idea of the structure of when the World Cup is, when the World 2020 is. And so finally, the Champions Trophy, which is, as I'm sure you and your listeners will know, it was the sort of poor man's version of the World Cup. I mean, there were one or two of them weren't too bad, but I mean, it's just one tournament too many now.
It just never seemed to have a natural place, did it, within the schedule? It always felt sort of crammed in. What do you feel the sort of, with the Champions Trophy going, do you think it is going to help? Because the big issue does seem to be sort of finding a balance between the three formats. I mean, do you think we're anywhere near a situation where we've found that, or...?
The balance between the three formats... sorry, so you just sort of rephrase that a bit, Andy.
I guess with the rise of 2020 and sort of the way that's kind of taken over so much of the schedule, I guess particularly with the IPL and the intrusion that's made, and then sort of the defining the role of the 50-over game, I guess just are we getting to a stage where we've got sort of the right amount of Test cricket, the right amount of 50-over, the right amount of T20?
Well, I mean, I'm concerned that we probably don't have quite enough Test cricket now. I mean, I don't go as far as some people do, saying that, a two-Test series is pointless. You know, there's a big movement at the moment of, saying, what are people doing having a two-Test series? Two-Test series is better than nothing. If you're in a country like New Zealand or Sri Lanka, where they really struggle to fill the grounds. I mean, if they're not going to make enough money out of the broadcast deals, then, it's not really, it's difficult to argue the case for having...
I guess the frustration's been, hasn't it? Because I think that's a very fair point, that I think for some of the Test nations, and I guess particularly you look at a team like Zimbabwe that are coming back into the Test game, a two-Test series is brilliant. But I guess what was concerning in the winter was sort of Australia and South Africa having a two-Test series.
Well, I mean, you do think two boards who've got a fair amount of money, and you think South Africa, surely they could fill the grounds for a third Test. But if you individually looked at some of the attendances, but even though there were only two Tests, some of the days outside the weekends was very, very poor. And it was a shame because the quality of the cricket was particularly...
It was fantastic,
I mean, Australia were a bit of a, beaten down dog after the Ashes. They were beginning to blood a few youngsters, and you know, looking to move on, you know, on their way up, and South Africa was sort of being taken down a peg or two, and it was a really absorbing series. And yeah, I mean, something
it
like
seemed
that.
So unfortunate to end it, didn't it? Sort of perfectly poised at 1-1 to end yeah. it and leave it. At
I mean, I think statistically, you see, there's no in a way. I mean, a two-test series could just as easily end in a result. It's a three-test series because you know one match could be drawn and the other could be a result, but it's of course inevitably. It's not
going to
work that way, is it?
Because I think I sort of very much share the concern that it seems like Test cricket is the one that is the format that's being sort of sacrificed. I mean, do you think there's a need for Test cricket to sort of, I guess, I hate to use the phrase, but sort of sell itself, almost make its case, try to get more people involved? Or does there just need to be an acceptance that actually it is a harder format to follow? It isn't always going to get the crowds or...
But it's an interesting one because you know, if you're going to ask the ICC to sort of try and market Test cricket in a way, that's what you're possibly suggesting. Now we've got this, you know, purported ICC Test Championship, which keeps on being delayed, and I think it was going to be 2013 next summer, and then they said they didn't have enough money. They didn't really say. Didn't really go into a lot of detail, but I think we're now waiting another 4 years before that ever gets off the ground. So, I think fans around the world need a context. They've got the world rankings, but that only means so much. If you need to qualify to get into the top four and then, you know, bring it to a knockout tournament together and then say, you know, Australia, England, India, whoever it is, you have won the Test Championship. Congratulations! I mean, I think that would actually create a bit of context for fans. It's still always going to be difficult to sell tickets in advance to say, you know, the second or third day of a Test in the UAE when Pakistan are hosting Sri Lanka or something. It's you know
there are certain situations where the Test cricket is kind of, I guess in the UAE case, by no fault of really anyone, it's just Pakistan's situation has made it very, very difficult. I guess looking away from the Test nations, mm-hmm. I mean, do you think the ICC is doing enough in terms of bringing through some of the associate nations? I mean, Ireland has made this kind of incredible push to sort of, they've looked really seriously at how they can get Test status. I mean, Afghanistan have had this incredible rise of just ridiculous speed from sort of nothing to, you know, international competition. I mean, do you think the ICC are doing enough in terms of bringing those countries forward?
I mean, I think that this, whatever it's called, this intercontinental trophy, which nobody knows much about. I mean, it doesn't. Well, I don't know what sort of media coverage it gets, but I
think it's just quick info, really. I don't think any.
Well, I remember having a chat with Sandip Bal, who's the editor of Crick Info, saying how much he follows it and all this stuff. I don't think he was being particularly genuine, but. I mean, yeah, I was actually making some notes the other day. And, you know, a lot of people have talked about dividing Test cricket into two tiers. If you did that, you could have England, Australia, South Africa, India, Pakistan and Sri Lanka in one tier. That would then put the other four nations into a second tier. And that would be the perfect opportunity to incorporate Ireland and Afghanistan. And then you'd have one tier of six and a second tier of six, promotion and relegation, you know, look at it, why not try something like that? And, you know, I don't think there's enough will to sort of...
Experiment and actually try...
Well, remember, I mean, and one of the reasons for this is that the ICC, unlike FIFA, unlike a lot of leading sports organisations, is not run by you know, dispassionate sort of third parties, run by its own members. You know, the 10 elite nations each have an equal say in the committee boardrooms at the top level of the ICC, and they're not, you know, in the same way that you talk about Turkey's never voting for Christmas, they're never going to vote for something that
going to really radically change. I mean, that idea of a two-tier thing, that does seem quite compelling because it does seem like a real opportunity to give some of these lesser nations a go at Test cricket. I mean, do you think you're now at the stage where Test cricket is almost naturally split in that way anyway? I mean, do you think, I mean, because I guess West Indies are one of the examples that comes up again mm-hmm. and again, you know, such a fantastic team in the 80s. I mean, is there, do you think there's any prospect of sides like the West Indies and New Zealand ever being consistently competitive again?
Or I'd love to see them both be competitive. And you've got slightly different problems in those two cases. In New Zealand, you've got a real problem with money within the sport, that it's barely professional at a first-class level. There's you know, the sponsors have dried up. People are looking to play. They're much more keen to get a contract in an English county than they are to play international cricket for their own country, which is very, very sad, but that's the truth. West Indies, you've got a lot of very good agents out there who are pushing their players towards IPL sides. And, you know, I was looking at an IPL game the other day, and I'm trying to remember what the player was called. I think it was called Kevin Cooper or something. Young West Indian, bowling quite nicely. And I think, you know, why haven't I even heard of, you know, why is it the first time I've heard of this young West Indian? It's within the context of the IPL.
To the book review, and this episode we're looking at Cricket Voices by Mihir Bose. Bose, a journalist who's really excelled and been successful, not just in the world of cricket, but also with football, has written for all the major papers, BBC Sports editor as well. And with this book, he's taken a very sort of interesting approach. He's consciously inspired by the American historian Studs Terkel. Fascinating name. And the idea is one of sort of around oral history. So you try to create a picture of cricket through speaking to those involved. And particularly Bose's focus on really interviewing people at all levels of the game. He offers very little analysis of his own. So each interview gets sort of a small little introduction, but kind of no more than that.
And I think that's the key difference between this book and some of the other books that follow a very similar format, such as Geoffrey Moorhouse's Best Loved Game and Duncan Hamilton's Last English Summer, which both attempt to build up a sort of portrait of a game at any particular point by going around and looking at various aspects of it. The thing about the Mihir Bose Cricket Voices is that because the author is ostensibly absent, because he's just saying, right here, I'm sort of giving a platform to various voices, it means that there's no real narrative thread, I think, partly through the whole thing. It's lots of sort of very discrete stories. But also, you're never quite sure where Bose himself is actually sort of intervening on how much it is just... So each interview is presented just as a straight chapter of continuous prose, and you're not sure quite how much editing has gone on by Bose or anything like that.
I mean, do you think it would have been improved by him having a more sort of prominent voice in the book, maybe more analysis, perhaps analysis kind of at the end of each interview, putting all in context?
Yeah, yeah, I think I very much like the idea, this idea you're talking about of oral history and of sort of giving people the opportunity to speak. I think that's very nice, but sometimes, often with an author of Bose's sort of caliber, you kind of do want him to be reading between the lines for you. Where I think he does come across very strongly is in some of the interviews where you kind of know that the people wouldn't actually have been saying what they're saying without having someone probing
away. It's kind of an invisible skill, though, isn't it? Because we don't get Bose's questions, and yet you're right that with certain people you see interesting ideas being tempted and sort of poked out of them. And
what interested you in particular? Which of the
issues? I mean, I think sort of going back to it, it's the Brian Bearshaw, cricket correspondent for the Manchester Evening News, was perhaps one of the most astonishing for me. He has a job as a cricket journalist that so many people would kill for.
Yep.
And yet he sounds sort of very underwhelmed by it. He talks of, it's become merely a job of work. In the summer, I'm writing about 250,000 words. It's a lot of words. It's hard work. And it's interesting because I think it's a discussion we've actually had before. It's this idea of kind of following cricket as fun and following cricket as a profession. And it seems impossible, reading someone like Bearshaw, for it not... Following it professionally necessarily seems to kill some of the romance. And I think he particularly talks about the constant need to file copy, file more words. And at that point, you know, when you talk about 250,000 words, it's no longer a question of crafted prose, is it? I mean, it's a question of...
Yes, it's and very often... with Bearshaw, but also there's a very interesting interview with Keith Boyce, the head groundsman at Headingley, both the cricket and the rugby ground. And by taking these people and taking different angles on the game that we than we usually see, you actually get quite a lot of insights. So with Boyce, there's it's quite interesting to see his perspective on all of those great Headingley games that you have happening through the 70s and 80s from the perspective of the pitch and the way that he sort of nurtures the pitch. And actually, I mean, at some level, it was strangely fascinating to find out the nerdy details of what kind of different topsoils you should use at different stages in the season and everything like that. But also, just the huge impact that he has and the responsibility he has when it comes to things like... you know, the infamous Botham test in the early 80s, and his perspective on that, which is a real insight, I think.
And it's interesting because it becomes something that he says, quite a niche topic, becomes something quite epic and almost something of a saga, his quest to fix that Headingley pitch, fix that difficult pitch. Amongst the players, I really enjoyed Mark Nicholas's feature. Particularly, he's very honest about how much he's hated his flashy reputation. Although at the same time, he admits that all my sporting heroes have been people who made the game look easy rather than equally great players who are gritty and determined. And it did make me wonder whether there isn't this divide amongst sports fans between those of us who cherish the workers and those of us who cherish the
We'll be debating.
And we are coming on to that later in the show.
Indeed. I think with in the Mark Nicholas interview, you get a sense of both as an interviewer coming through very powerfully, because Nicholas, we all have this image of him from his slightly, sometimes slightly crass Channel 4 commentary. But actually, it's quite a sort of uncomfortably candid interview, and he talks about the fact that his father died when he was very young, and the role that his mother had in his life, and how that has shaped him, and how his mother had to give up everything to send him to school. So this image of him having grown up with a silver spoon in his mouth is undeserved. And so you get there a really strong sense of it actually needs a very good interviewer to have actually got this material out of him. And I think it's there that you feel the presence of both in the book.
And there are moments of painful honesty. I mean, I had found a really interesting piece on Jeremy Batty, who at that time was a young upcoming Yorkshire cricketer, a young off-spinner, incredibly highly rated by the county, seen
brother
as a huge...
Brother
of Gareth, indeed, and seen as a huge prospect for the future. And it seemed very weird reading this in hindsight, being slightly haunting, because you are aware that Batty's career never really amounted to anything like what he wanted it to. And you're reading of his hopes and dreams of playing for England, things. And it did leave you wondering, this endless number of, not just cricketers, sportsmen every year who risk everything, who put so much effort and energy into a dream that necessarily... I mean, there was something sad about it. You read that sort of like that youthful optimism and excitement. Yeah. And then you realise, God, that the odds are so against you as a young sportsman.
So, Mihir Bose... Cricket Voices, not recommended to be read straight through from beginning to end, but a very interesting portrait of the game nevertheless. So, to the debate, and this episode we're asking whether batting should prize substance over style.
And ultimately, all the legendary cricket batsmen are men of substance. They're the players who, over a long career, a long period of time, kept making huge numbers of runs, whatever the situation, whatever the circumstances. I mean, think about the definitive batsman. Actually, go further than that, the definitive cricketer, Don Bradman. He made thousands of runs, and it's the average that people look to. It's not the way he made the runs that impressed people. It's the sheer quantity that he made. It's that almost three-figure average that really astonishes and really establishes Bradman's greatness. A stunning off-drive, or a stunning cut, a stunning pull, they're momentary things of beauty. They're a wonderful exhibition of a piece of skill. But the whole point of cricket is not about those individual moments. It's about sort of greater accomplishments. And actually, if you contrast one lovely shot with a painfully grafted 100 in tough conditions, that is a true accomplishment. That's when the game is at its finest. That's when the game's at its best. And ultimately, the skill of batting has never been about odd flashy shots. Cricket is a mental game more than anything else. It's another huge cliche, but it's true. And great batting is about mental strength. It's not about the technique to play the one odd shot. I mean, I ask you, as the West Indians roll into town, And that's a lovely image, actually. We're getting excited, really, not about... I mean, maybe a few of us are getting excited about watching Darren Sammy carve a couple of big sixes. We're getting excited about watching Shiv Chandrapal bat for 4 days, let's be honest about this.
Yes, you might be. You might be. You might be the kind of character who watches unedited Chris Tavares footage on loop late at night. But I think, ultimately, the fact is that cricket is... It's a sport. It's an art. It's not about whatever the outcome is per se. And actually, cricket isn't won by the team that accumulates the most runs. So actually, the idea that just pure batting.
Hang on a second.
Let me have.
I think that might just be cricket. Sort of is run by the team that accumulates the most runs.
No, it's not.
How is it not?
You have to take wickets as well. Just the idea that it's pure substance over anything else is I think.
Okay, so let that one pass.
But actually, the point about cricket is it's a thing of beauty. It's a thing to watch and it's a thing to enjoy. And absolutely, there is a certain beauty about watching someone accumulate runs, and there's a certain style that's done there. But actually, I don't think that pure substance, as you're putting it, you know, runs regardless of how it looks, is actually really the point of the game per se. And actually, there's a wider issue here, which is actually that very often it's the most stylish batsmen who are the most effective. So, for instance, there are two ways of scoring runs, one of which is to play ugly kind of blacksmith-like heaves over over long on. There's another one, which is just to imperiously watch the ball onto your bat and just hit a perfectly timed little on drive to the boundary. And actually, I don't think there's this great antithesis which you've kind of set up between having substance and style. A degree of style and a degree of technical ability, which is actually where we bring style from. So when we think of style, we think of a kind of MCC coaching manual, and there's a reason it's MCC coaching manual. It's because it's most effective. So you can't just say it's got to be substance and there's nothing to do with style.
I think it's very possible for a stylish batsman to have considerable substance. I mean, if we look at perhaps the batsman of our generation, someone like Sachin Tendulkar, he's a batsman who consistently produces and is also consistently wonderful to watch. It's very, very possible. I think where it becomes interesting, though, is perhaps when you have... So there are the great players who have both. And I would say, actually, off the top of my head, I'm thinking of someone like a great Kevin Peterson innings, where you think he's produced for his team at a time when they need it, and he's done it with style.
Michael Vaughan.
Okay, Vaughan as well. I mean, there are several we could point to, but...
Ian Bell.
If it's a choice between the two, and I think sometimes there is... There are players who have style and they have the ability to crash and bash, not necessarily crash and bash, but an ability to sort of put together a classy sort of 30 or 40. Or if you look back to the Ashes, for example, last winter and look at the way Alistair Cook played, no one would defend the style of the way Cook played, but no one would similarly question the greatness of the way he played.
Oh, no, I'm not saying there's any difference in the greatness, but all I'm saying is that... in essence, an enjoyment, and I think this is where we kind of fundamentally disagree, an enjoyment of cricket, I think, does come from... cricket is all about individual moments. It's about a series of individual moments in the context of other individual moments. A ball hitting the bat and then being fielded is what is a moment. And yes, absolutely, it depends what's happening on the moments around it. But actually, when you're sitting watching a game of cricket, there is absolutely no fun if the only aim of it is to accumulate runs regardless of everything else. And actually, I think there's something about the fact that cricket is a luxury. It's not, well, with the IPL it is, but it's not a business towards which an end is constantly being strived. It's a kind of cricket for cricket's sake argument, I suppose I'm trying to say, which is that there is an inherent beauty to cricket.
I mean,
being
this
played.
Idea that cricket being about moments, I do understand what you're getting at, but at the same time, I think what's memorable at cricket, you know, a great innings is memorable in a way that individual shots aren't, I don't think. I think an individual shot can be a fine, fine thing, and it's a wonderful thing when you're watching a game. But actually, what's truly memorable, what sticks in the mind, is perhaps the defiance of an innings,
yeah,
a well played innings.
But there's a certain style about the way that you can construct an innings. I mean, style isn't just a lovely cover drive, say. Style is the way that, you know, David Gower rolled up his shirt sleeve, and the way that one can construct an innings all the way through.
If we think, though, about the fact that cricket is ultimately, I mean, it's a sport very much about individual contests, but it is a team game. Isn't style often an extremely selfish way to play the game? I mean, often when you prize... that over delivering for your team. Isn't that actually, you're consciously making quite a selfish choice?
Yeah, no, I can see that, certainly. But I don't think it's a complete opposition, one against the other. I don't think anyone would say, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go out and I'm going to leave every ball with the most stylish leave possible because that's how I'm going to look stylish. I mean, the whole point about style is ultimately, as I was saying about the fact that what we think of as style is actually kind of technical correctness, and that actually it's the most effective way to play as opposed to the, you know, just being stylish for style's
sake. Is an unnecessary but slightly brilliant reverse swept for style. It's unnecessary. It's not necessarily the most efficient way to. It's actually quite a risky way to do it, but the spectators love it. It's very entertaining. It's well executed.
I don't think people play reverse sweeps for the sake of being stylish.
Do you not think there's an element of grandstanding about it?
I don't think Michael Vaughan thinks, okay, it's a half volley outside off some, God, I've got, here's an opportunity to look stylish. I think he just creams it through the covers and it's a lovely, lovely shot.
There's an element of showboating. Kevin Peterson reverse hits Muralitharan for six on another day. That's showboating. That's got nothing to do with the easiest way. It does several things.
Yes, there's a style in inverted commas about it. It also puts an awful lot of doubt into the batsman's way. It's not being done purely for the sake of style. It makes the captain think, okay, I've got to actually defend against someone who's basically batting on both sides of the wicket. I mean, it's not. I don't think it's just purely about the fact that he just wants to look good.
I mean, I think we could agree
with Kevin Peterson, you never really know. But
yeah. I mean, I think we could agree that the holy grail of this is to be a batsman who makes a huge number of runs and does it stylishly.
And looks good.
And they are the players who we prize and follow. Thanks for listening to the 31st episode of Reverse Sweep Radio. We'll be back in a couple of weeks where we will be reflecting on hopefully the arrival of the sunshine and the start of the test summer.